Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I think if you ask most Americans what is the existential crisis facing the world right now, I think most Americans would say global warming. And part of that is using the words existential and planet.
Right.
And you're not going to get student loan debt from existential and planet. But to a lot of Americans, student loan debt may be a bigger issue than global warming in their immediate lives. With me in our studio in Washington, D.C. is Michael Mann. Now, when you talk to people who know the world of climate science and you ask them who would be your first choice to be a guest on global warming, Michael Mann is what they come up with. He was one of the lead authors of the Observed Climate Variability and Change chapter of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is, everyone talks about, is the IPCC. Their third scientific assessment report, and that's way back in 2001. He shared the Nobel Prize with other scientists on the IPCC in 2007. He has been recognized with so many awards in this field that he's kind of the Meryl Streep of climate science. And I hope you're not embarrassed.
Not at all.
Dr. Mann is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State and director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. And he came here to Washington, D.C. to do the podcast. And I want to thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you, Al. It's a real pleasure for me to be able to do this interview with you.
Oh, great, great, great. Okay. Your research, and I read this, involves the use of theoretical models and observational data to better understand Earth's climate system. And reading Dyer predictions, I understand exactly what that means. This is a pretty sophisticated primer, I think, on climate change. It's called Dyer Predictions, Understanding Climate Change. And it says a visual guide, but it's not like a visual guide like for my grandson.
No, this is really, it is an attempt to take the very dense and technical Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, which are by and large completely inaccessible to the lay public, and sort of boil it down in language and using graphics that are more accessible.
Inaccessible meaning we couldn't understand it, or we can't get a hold of them.
Very difficult to understand.
Okay, yes.
Without some knowledge in the field. Yeah.
Yeah, but you can understand this, which is,
well, that's what we hope.
Yeah.
That was the aim.
There are times where I went, huh? So my question, with all that lead in, is how fucked are we?
Well, as I like to say, and that, in fact, that is the right framing, because people sometimes
say, finally, well, someone asked you the right question. Well,
in the wrong question is, are we effed or not? Because it isn't binary. It's a matter of how effed. And the more we act and the sooner we act, the less effed we
are.
We
want to be less fucked than more fucked. And every day is a chance to be less or more.
Right. So there is, agency. We can have an impact on our future. And that's very important to keep in mind, because there is too much, in my assessment, way too much sort of doom and gloom and a sense that we sort of gone beyond the point of no return with climate change. And that simply isn't the case. Every action that we make
in the sense that it's how fucked are we?
Right.
It's a question. So we've gone you know, we blew it in the 80s, whenever you want to say we blew it.
Right. I mean, we've already seen damaging climate change impacts, so there's no way to avoid that. It's already happened.
Right.
And there's more in the pipeline. The question is, how bad are we willing to let it get?
Well, how bad? You know, when I think about that, I just had my fourth grandchild. And by that,
congratulations.
I mean, thank you. By that, I mean, I personally gave birth to Claire Franken. And this is, she's 7 weeks old now. And I realize if, you know, she has a really good chance of making it to the next century. The first thing I did was stop using a leaf blower that I use all the time. That's an internal combustion engine, so a gas thing. You know, I don't want my four grandchildren, Joe, Jacob, Avery, and Claire, I don't want them 50 years from now to say to hey, Grandpa, you were a senator. You knew climate change was happening. Why didn't you do anything? And also, why are you still alive? Because I'd be like 118. So I said, well, I talked to Michael Mann and get the people involved in exercise and knowledgeable. Because part of what I want to do today, and we'll get to it, is I want to for you to arm the audience with what to say to the crazy uncle, the crazy aunt, the crazy...
It's usually an uncle.
Let's start with how many billion people are on the planet right now?
So there are more than 7.5 billion people now and growing.
Okay, and how many are from underdeveloped countries?
Well, the majority of that population, yeah.
Okay, and how do we prevent them from expanding their economies?
Well, you know, I see it not as a question of whether or not they expand their economies. They're entitled to do so.
Okay, I was kidding.
Yeah.
in the sense that they're going to, and because they are going to expand their economies, they're not going to be able to do it the way we did.
Right.
And
exactly.
We did it with fossil fuel. We did it with coal.
That's the point. We want to help them leapfrog past fossil fuels to the new technology that's now available that can provide them with the energy they need without continuing to do damage to the planet.
And why wouldn't they leapfrog? You know, for example, they use iPhones or cell phones,
right.
And that's a leapfrog.
Yep.
I don't know. You know, they're probably most people in the underdeveloped world never had a line, you know, into their house,
right.
For God's sakes.
Right.
So they hopefully will leapfrog this.
Right.
And but we have to help them, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. And we're part of Paris was helping them. Was agreeing to help them.
And indeed, that was one of the parts of the agreement that was immediately attacked by fossil fuel interests and the Trump administration, because they know how critical that is to helping the rest of the world transition away from fossil fuels, something they don't want to happen.
Right. Are they all bad people? I mean, is every one of them a bad person? There are people that work for ExxonMobil who are good people.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, in fact, you know, there are a few bad apples at the top is the problem, who have, in essence, led those companies astray. Decades ago, ExxonMobil's own scientists identified the catastrophic potential threat of climate change in the internal documents.
And then they went right to work letting people know about it and releasing what science they had and funding, you know, centers that would dispense this information, spread it far and wide.
That's the alternative universe I wish I lived in.
Oh, they didn't do that. They did kind of the opposite, right?
Yep.
So they funded, what are the organizations they funded? Because many of them are still around, right?
Yeah, I mean, they created all sorts of front groups with fancy-sounding names like Americans for Prosperity. Who wouldn't be for prosperity, right?
I am.
Unless you realize that it's just a front group for the fossil fuel industry.
It is?
Oh, no. Yes, there you are.
God, I love that name.
The Heartland Institute. Doesn't that sound like an upright organization to you?
Oh, I bet you it was near Minneapolis then.
Chicago, based in Chicago, far.
You see?
And, of course, a front group for tobacco. Big tobacco and fossil fuels.
There's a kind of relationship between the tobacco science and the climate science in terms of the industry withholding it.
That's right.
So the tobacco industry famously all lied in front of Congress. And
they wrote the playbook, and the fossil fuel industry has run with it.
Yeah, give me a parallel of what they did with tobacco and what they did with climate.
So with tobacco, they hid the fact that their product was killing people. The fossil fuel industry has hid the fact that their product is killing the planet.
Okay, very nice parallel. The Meryl Streep of climate science. I went to the Paris conference. Our delegation met with Bangladesh. And they have so much at stake here. And they were so nice. They were so sweet. And I hate to use that word, but that was the best adjective. And they are already feeling it. I mean, there can be millions and millions of Bangladeshis who will be fugitives, who will be climate refugees.
Right.
It's a very low country, a very populated country. The seawater is already making some of the land not arable, and yet they were as sweet, as nice as could be to us. I felt awful.
And they had the least role in creating this problem, and they're the ones who are bearing the brunt of it.
Yeah. I wonder what that is going to do militarily. Because I remember the Defense Department did a millennial report a few years ago during the Obama administration and said that the number one threat to our country was climate change.
Yeah.
That's the Defense Department.
Yep. You hear this from four-star generals, the head of the Pacific Naval Fleet. This is what our national security community is telling us. It's what they call a threat multiplier, right? Because it takes existing tensions and it heightens those tensions. So you've got 7.5 billion and growing people, as we said, more and more people on this planet competing for less food, less water, and less space, in substantial part because of the impacts of climate change. And that's a recipe for conflict and, you know, a sort of perfect storm of national security calamities, if you will.
Okay, now how much of that will be addressed by the research and development we do into growing crops in hot, dry soil or adapting?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what USDA is doing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, at least was under Obama, right?
We can buy a little bit of time and flexibility through adaptation, but if in a worst-case scenario where we continue, you know, to burn fossil fuels, business as usual, for the next century, there's no amount of adaptation that will provide us the resilience that we need.
Okay. The question really is, I think, is... Yeah. Because, I mean, renewables will be cheaper. Well, they're already cheaper than a new coal plant, for goodness sakes.
Right.
You and I had a discussion on the phone about natural gas and about fracking. And, you know, a lot of people think of natural gas as like a transition to 100% renewables because the best feature of natural gas is that you can just start it up. If your wind and solar is not producing 100% of the need, they can fire up natural gas like you couldn't do with coal. Coal has to keep going.
Right.
But you're saying, and I know this is a big problem with natural gas, is the venting.
Right.
And that is methane. And that is a multiplier bad of carbon dioxide in the short term, right?
Yeah. It doesn't stay in the atmosphere as long as CO2. So in the long and carbon dioxide. So in the long term, it's not as much of a factor, as much of a problem. But if you look at timescales of 10 to 20 years, then methane can be as much as 100% more of a warming gas than carbon dioxide. Nearly 100 times larger warming effect per molecule. Now, there are less of those molecules around.
Okay.
Methane is in...
It's a bigger molecule.
But the main thing is that it exists in much lower concentrations than CO2.
Okay.
But the fact is that each methane molecule is a lot more potent, especially on that time scale of 20 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And the worry, of course, is over the next 10 to 20 years, we pass certain tipping points where we set in motion the destruction of most of the continental ice sheets, locking in tens of feet of global sea level rise, right?
Also, I mean, you multiplier effects are something you write about in this,
yeah.
And one of them is the permafrost melting.
Right. So,
and that releases an incredible amount of methane.
Yeah. Now, there's some debate about just how much methane could be mobilized, by sort of that near-term warming. There are some scientists who have argued that it would be on a par with CO2. Most scientists will tell you, no, the main warming effect is still going to be the carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuels. But as you allude to, this is a multiplying effect. It can give us more warming.
Okay, so a warming, what do you call it, a warming gas? No, you don't call it.
A greenhouse gas.
A greenhouse gas. Okay, yeah. What a greenhouse gas is, it's a greenhouse gas because it absorbs the sun's heat. The radiation, tell me.
Okay, so here I'm schooling Al Franken, folks. It's something I've always wanted to do.
Well, you're a fucking climate scientist.
It's an honor to be discussing the science with you, sir. So with a greenhouse gas, these are gases made up of molecules, carbon dioxide, methane, water vapor, that are able to absorb the heat energy that is trying to escape from Earth's surface. So it turns out that these particular molecules are able to rotate and vibrate in ways that absorb what we call infrared radiation. That's the heat radiation that the Earth is trying to send out to space to cool off as it's heated by the sun. And that's what determines Earth's temperature, is that balance between the heating by the sun and the amount of this invisible heat energy, infrared radiation, that it sends out to space. And what the greenhouse gases do is they absorb some of that heat energy, mm-hmm. as it's trying to escape into space, and they re-emit it in all directions, which means some of it escapes to space, but some of it goes back down. So now
right.
the surface...
So more heat comes back down
exactly.
than otherwise would have.
So that means the Earth has to produce even more of that outgoing heat energy to cool off, and it increases its temperature to do that. Then
oh Jesus! Wow!
A caller? Can
well,
we?
Well, it's so
a caller
stupid.
Question?
No. I. Oh my God! Let me turn this damn thing off. There we go. I don't want to drop names. It's Bob Carey.
Bob Carey? Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I have Medal of Honor winners.
Yeah.
Seek my advice. I was once on a taping, and it wasn't Letterman, but it was something like that, and that happened, and I had prepared a line for it, like, years before in case that ever happened.
Right.
And it was, I need a liver. and we've got some good news. Guy was on a motorcycle without a helmet, and we got some really good news.
Okay, yeah.
That was... The two jokes.
Do you ever feel like you're settling? For your foundation, that is. Maybelline's new Instant Age Rewind Eraser Foundation doesn't settle into fine lines and wrinkles. With SPF 20 and moisturizing Pro Vitamin B5, this foundation not only provides medium coverage and a natural finish, but also protects and nourishes your skin. And the best part? The blurring sponge tip applicator makes application a breeze. Say goodbye to cakey, uneven foundation, and hello to a flawless, radiant complexion. Try our new foundation today and see the difference for yourself at amazon.com/instant-eraser-foundation.
You know one thing I read in this, which I thought was really interesting?
Yeah.
Because the ocean is warming up, right?
Right.
And so you said the cold water holds gas, more carbonation, like you
yeah.
said, the carbon. And so that's why a cold Diet Pepsi has more effervescence
that's
than
right.
a warm Diet Pepsi.
That's right. And in fact, a cold water holds more dissolved oxygen.
Right.
That's part of why, and which, you know, fish need, for example. So that's why the warming of the oceans is a problem for fish populations.
I have always said, give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. Teach a man the fish, you feed him for life, unless there are no fish.
That's right.
And that's why this is so important.
That's right. For me, it's an analog for how we arm people with information. Because You know, when it comes to Uncle Charlie, your climate change denying uncle at Thanksgiving, you know, comes armed with the latest climate change denial talking points, you know.
Okay, that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
What are those? And tell me what you say to them.
Yeah.
So, that's what I want. That's what, that if we do anything here, we got to do that.
Yeah. No. And your listeners probably aren't going to remember what we discussed here in this program, but I'm going to provide a resource that they can use and they can have right at their fingertips when Uncle Charlie comes armed with his climate change denying talking points.
You can use your phone.
Skeptical Science, a website. They've got an app that you can download that has the 100+ main climate change denier myths with
wow.
the responses to it right at your fingertips.
Okay, well, let's go through them now.
Yeah.
Not all 100, but the kind of the...
Yeah.
The good ones.
Well, there's sort of a hierarchy,
okay,
right? Sometimes called the stages of denial.
Mm-hmm.
The most fundamental denial.
Okay,
is,
let's go.
Right.
Let's get right to them.
The first stage of denial is that, you know, it's not happening, that carbon dioxide isn't increasing in the atmosphere, and there's really, you know, no way you could possibly support that claim.
It feels like if you have someone saying that,
right,
it's hard to argue with them, isn't it?
Well, if they're not open to
evidence
and reason and data, then it's always a struggle. And sometimes that's the case. Sometimes what you find...
Where are they hearing that now? Are they hearing it on right-wing talk radio?
Yes. Well, your good friend Rush Limbaugh, for example, would be, you know, example of...
It doesn't matter if the... ice caps melt. Well, if you put an ice cube in a glass, my friends, and it melts, it's the same. It goes to the same level.
Yeah, but Greenland is not an ice cube. Land.
Yeah.
Antarctica is like a continent.
Yeah.
So there you go, Rush.
Yeah, Rush's model of the world is a little simplistic, unfortunately. And
I guess I'm wrong.
Yeah, it's something you'll never hear. you'll never hear that, oddly enough.
Okay, so how do you deal with that?
Yeah. So again, if somebody isn't willing to accept the
anyone
evidence,
who says that isn't willing to accept. I mean,
they're probably coming from a place of bad faith or ideology. They don't want to know.
Okay, let's get rid of that one.
Yeah, we'll get rid of that.
If someone comes with that, you just go, eh.
We've been measuring it. You can see it climbing year by year. There's no question.
Look at this
about
chart.
That.
It's a phony chart. He'll say those guys get paid by. You know, fresh fruits and vegetable interests.
Right. The higher the CO2, the more money they make, right?
Yeah. So it's,
at some point, you move on, right? You say, this person is lost.
Let's get past that guy.
We'll go to the next person who may be reachable, right?
This is what I want to hear because I want to arm our people
absolutely
with something useful.
So, you know, then the argument is, okay, well, maybe the carbon dioxide is increasing, but there's no evidence of warming. And again, it just comes down to whether or not they're willing to accept the overwhelming evidence.
This is my response to there's no evidence of warming. Right. Why is sea level rising? How do you explain that unless there's warming? Because it's a combination of when water's warmer, it expands, and also the ice caps melting. And so how does a person explain rising sea level?
Mo Brooks, Republican congressman from Alabama, who just months ago made waves, no pun intended, for claiming that sea level rise was due to rocks falling into the ocean. You may remember that. It got a little bit of press coverage.
I actually don't remember that.
Mo Brooks has his own theory for global sea level rise. It's rocks falling into the ocean.
That's what he said.
Yeah, that's what he said.
Every single year that we're on Earth, you have huge tons of silt deposited by the Mississippi River, by the Amazon River, by the Nile, by every major river system, and for that matter, creek, all the way down to the smallest systems. And every time you have that soil or rock, whatever it is that is deposited into the seas, that forces the sea levels to rise because now you've got less space in those oceans because the bottom is moving up.
I'm pretty sure
the White Cliffs of Dover, California, where you have the waves crashing against the shorelines, and time again, you're having the cliffs crash into the sea. All of that displaces water, which forces it to rise, does it not?
I'm pretty sure that on human timescales, those are minuscule effects.
That's really crazy.
Well, right. But, I mean, right. Well, and if it were just that thing, then you can imagine, right? And this is sort of the tactic used by climate change deniers, mm-hmm. is to sort of isolate one piece of evidence and then sort of focus their contrarianism in it.
Okay,
on attempting
what's the,
to discredit
what is
that.
The piece of evidence they go to? What's a, well, a no, common? No. Do they, you know, like a basketball player just goes to his right. Right. What's a climate denier? What do they go to? What piece of evidence do they go to?
Right.
Specifically?
So again, with sea level rise, mm-hmm. they'll say, "Oh, well, the sea level is rising, but it's natural. It's part of a long term." Natural warming after we came out of the last ice age. And then the problem is, okay, well, it has accelerated dramatically over the last several decades. Mm-hmm. And it isn't just the sea level that's rising. It's the ice that's melting. And we're measuring that. We're measuring the warming of the surface, the warming in the oceans, the warming of the northern hemisphere, the warming of the southern hemisphere.
Okay, so now let's, I love the ice age stuff because the sense of time.
Yeah.
The age of the Earth, the amount of time between ice ages, scope of time like dinosaurs. How long were the dinosaurs around?
They were around for hundreds of millions of years.
Hundreds of millions of years.
And in fact,
okay,
not billions, but
hundreds of millions of years.
So, for example, the Jurassic and the early Jurassic, the Stegosaurus, it's a right. couple hundred million years ago. The Tyrannosaurus Rex died with the extinction event known as the KT impact, this asteroid impact. 65
Huge asteroid hits.
Right.
Now,
65
Jupiter...
million years ago. To give you a sense of how misleading our sense of time and mm-hmm. past time can be, I like to point out to people that there is less time that elapsed between the Tyrannosaurus Rex and us than elapsed between the Stegosaurus and the Tyrannosaurus Rex. They lived farther apart from each other than we lived from the Tyrannosaurus Rex. It was an early Jurassic dinosaur. The T-Rex was a late Cretaceous dinosaur. And those are hundreds of millions of years apart. We're only 65 million years away from the T-Rex. Now, you asked about the ice ages. That's a shorter time scale.
Okay, okay.
But still, it's instructive to think about that because people will say, one of the arguments would be, well, hey, there were... You know, there's an ice sheet covering, you know, a large part of North America.
They always say, right? This is when I was on the Energy Committee, and when all these Trump appointees or nominees would come before us, and I'd say, do you believe in climate change? And they'd say, well, the climate has always been changing.
Right.
And we don't know how much man has to do with it,
right.
Which is like a little bit more of an acknowledgement that right. man may have something to do with
right,
it.
Right, exactly. And then yeah. if you press them on it, they'll say, well, I'm not a climate scientist.
Mm-hmm. I'm just an undersecretary of climate.
Right. Exactly. And we do have some actual climate scientists who know something about the science, and here's what they say.
Oh, man. Michael Lewis was on podcast. His book, The Fifth Risk, is the best book about the Trump administration, because you don't have to read about Trump very much.
Yeah,
it's about the Ag Department, about Commerce, and about the Energy Department. And what happens is that they don't do the transition. They don't do what you normally do, which is bring 30 people to the Ag Department from your transition team and 30 or more than 30 people from the last administration, and mainly career people, explain what you do and what each function is. What they would do, they just didn't show up.
Right.
They just didn't show up. But when they did show up, both at agriculture and at energy, the only thing they asked was, we'd like a list of all the people who went to climate meetings.
Right. Yeah. Are you now or have you ever been a climate scientist?
That's good. That's a good scene. Oh, man. Oh, man. This Trump coming in, getting out of Paris. I guess they drew up regulations that you can't say climate change or you can't.
In Florida, for example, the former governor wanted to outlaw use of that term in any state-related matters. They don't want to talk about it, right? And as you say, they're trying to starve those governmental departments and institutions that are tasked with acting on things like climate change. That's been their approach.
Yeah, this is kind of and this is their ties to the fossil fuel industry,
right?
And this is guys mainly, but I guess some women in the fossil fuel industry who are going like Citizens United, Republicans, Citizens United happened.
Right.
If you say that you believe in climate change and yet we have to do something about it, you're going to be primaried.
Right. Exactly. Well, and a good friend of mine, you may know, Bob Inglis, Republican congressman in South Carolina, was primaried by essentially by the Koch brothers, right? This is Citizens United,
Money.
And so what we have
he's sort of the poster child.
And so what we have is literally a hand-selected by the Koch brothers cabinet, a virtual dream team of fossil fuel lobbyists and climate change deniers running the EPA, the Interior, and all the departments.
And that's not so different from the George W. Bush administration, that Cheney picked those people.
That's right. I don't know if you've seen the film Vice.
I have.
Yeah. Brilliant. Adam McKay.
I actually did not expect it to be as good as it was. It was very effective. The performance is amazing. But I also thought, you know, the liberties he took, I thought were all great.
There's this montage at the end of Vice. You see all these scenes, and it's sort of telling you all the things that happened because of the intervention by Dick Cheney when he basically took over midway through the George W. Bush administration. One of the things you see in that montage, and it's very deliberate, are the California wildfires. What he's telling you, and it's true, is that it was the intervention by Cheney and the energy industry midway through that first term where there was this divergence, where the Republicans did become the party of climate change denialism and fossil fuel advocacy. And in my book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, in the beginning of one of the chapters...
The hockey stick is the line...
It's the curve that we published 20 years ago, became sort of an icon in the climate change debate, and I was attacked by the usual suspects, climate change deniers, looking to discredit it. But in the book, I start out one of the chapters with a speech, and you're told that this was a speech given by one of the two candidates in the 2000 election. You'd read that speech, you'd be sure it was Al Gore, and it wasn't. It was W., and it was all about how we're going to act on climate change. We're going to regulate carbon. That's actually where W. was on the campaign trail. And when he came into office, he appointed Christine Todd Whitman, who was a wonderful EPA administrator, who was the first EPA administrator to say that carbon dioxide should be regulated under the Clean Air Act. And then the Cheney gang came in.
Cheney got, got involved, and Mr. President, why don't I take that off your shoulders? I think you have a lot of stuff to do, and I'd be happy to do that.
I mean, but okay. So the Republican Party becomes this party that is just denying climate change, and then after Citizens United, it just becomes impossible, right?
Because they're a wholly owned subsidiary of the Koch brothers in the fossil fuel industry. That's what they become.
Yeah. And now they're kind of a wholly owned subsidiary of Trump because the Republican Party is 90% for Trump.
Right.
And so if they are in a primary, if they say anything about Trump, they're dead. Give me another climate denier thing.
Yeah, so, you know, it's not warming, and then they concede that, okay, it's warming because the evidence is very clear. Well, and you alluded to this already, right? This is one of the standard talking points you hear from climate change denying politicians is, well, we don't know how much of it is due to human activity, which is also a lie. We do. You know, it's very clear from the science that all of the warming that we've seen of the planet over the last century is due to the increase in greenhouse gases from fossil fuel burning and other human activities. And here's the clincher. If it were natural factors that were governing, alone were governing the climate should have cooled over the last few decades, because there was sort of a plateau and a dip in how much energy was coming in from the sun. We can measure that with satellites. There were a number of big volcanic eruptions, which put lots of particles in the atmosphere, cools the planet. Mm-hmm. So if you put together those primary natural factors into climate models, they tell you the climate should have cooled over that time frame.
Okay, but they're not gonna buy that from you.
And then you move on, right? If you find that you're speaking to a brick wall.
That would be like if you have somebody who's just been a relative or someone who's reasonably intelligent,
right,
and they just happen to be right-wing and they just happen to watch Fox all the time, you could have that conversation.
Maybe.
Then try to prove it by going to go to the computer and just kind of...
If they've been that subject to that ideological bubble for that long, then they see this, you know, through a purely sort of tribal, you know, if they're going to be...
We're very tribal now.
Very tribal. So they can't concede that climate change is real and human-caused because it's going against their tribe. And the Republican Party, I mean, the fossil fuel interests were very clever in branding that, right, and spending billions of dollars to imprint climate change denialism in the identity of the Republican Party, because now it is part of that tribal identity.
You know, it's really easy for someone to believe something where their paycheck depends on them believing it, right? My former Republican colleagues, I'm sure they just go, I'm going to have to not believe in climate change.
Right.
And
right.
If it's easier for me not to believe in climate change, then I guess I don't.
Right. Well, Upton Sinclair, of course, famously said, you know, it's very difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it. And that's what we have.
Yeah, here. He was paraphrasing something I just said.
Right. Well, that's clear. That's clearly true. James Inhofe, the senator who introduced a snowball on the Senate floor to disprove all 200 years of.
I asked him.
Yeah.
I said, Jim, could I just bring a snowball in? I said, if I came in and I'd really pack it hard, because, you know, in Minnesota, we do a lot of snowball fights are a big deal.
Right.
And so I really made it hard. And you're at your desk. And I just start saying how stupid what you said was. Okay. And then I whip it.
Whip it good.
Whip it good.
Yeah.
At you, and then would you just have a thing where your glasses are crooked and you put like what looks like I hit you right in the eye? Would you do that? And he said no. He was a nice man. I mean, in the sense when you talked to him, he was friendly.
Oh yeah.
And,
yeah.
And I thought maybe
deep,
you know, maybe
misguided.
He'll do that. Yeah. Maybe he'll play along with that. That would be funny. You don't see like anything like that.
No sense of humor. A few years ago, he was on the Rachel Maddow show. He actually said in this interview that he used to believe what the science had to say until he found out how much it would cost. He actually said this. that's a true gaffe, right?
It's really?
Betrays. Okay.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Oh, well, let's talk about the cost. That's what I wanted to get to. I want to talk about the cost.
Right.
Because you talked about the wildfires in California.
Right.
How much did it cost? I mean, what What was the damage? That must have been like $100 billion. Yeah,
hundreds of billions of dollars. And these disasters, we used to call them natural disasters, not really natural disasters because we're making them worse from climate change, right? These unprecedented.
Oh, well, our wildfire seasons have been extended. The fires are
bigger.
No, there
isn't the wildfire season in California anymore. It's just one perpetual, yeah.
But nationally, I mean, the Forest Service has to spend all of its money now on firefighting, and there's no money to even treat the forests that you can thin them and try to prevent it.
This gets to the crux of your question, right? Because the cost of action is dwarfed by the cost of inaction.
Exactly.
We're talking trillions of dollars of gross domestic product globally. Climate change is costing us trillions of dollars a year.
And it's going to cost more and more and more and
absolutely.
More. And it's going to be, what are we doing? What are we going to do? Build sea barriers along the coast? You know,
it's not cheap to relocate all of the major coastal cities of the world. That's not going to be cheap.
And also, like, rich people have houses on the ocean, right?
Don't cry for the Koch brothers. They'll be fine. But everybody else who doesn't have those resources is paying the price, right? So they're getting record profits. Fossil fuel plutocrats are making record profits while everybody else is paying the price.
Okay, so the cost of inaction much higher than the cost of action. Action brings a lot of good things with it, too. There is going to be a huge market, and there is a huge market for renewable energy, right?
Yep.
We shouldn't let the Chinese lead in that.
Right.
And we have.
Right.
And that's ridiculous. It's stupid. And we spend less money on research and development than we used to.
Right.
As a percentage of our GDP. In the government. I've always thought of this. Why didn't ExxonMobil or Exxon, why didn't they go like, you know what? We are the biggest energy company in the world. Why don't we go into solar? I mean, we would be, if that had happened, we would have been invading Saudi Arabia for the sun, for the desert.
Right. Well, you know, I think there's an alternative universe where that's what happened. Unfortunately, we're stuck in the one where that isn't what happened.
And they didn't do it because they had all these oil wells. And,
all
these oil wells are still producing and cost nothing. I just want to, I'm
just
looking at my notes, and I just want to say something bad about the Republicans.
Okay.
Here's one. So we had a hearing on rising sea level. And only Lisa Murkowski came. At least she came. She was a chairman of the committee.
Yeah.
But none of them would come. And, of course, they went rising sea level. Oh, it's going to be about climate change. Yeah. And then they didn't show up.
Yeah.
And then at that hearing, one of the witnesses said, you know, because of rising sea level, the storm surges are going to be really bad. And the New York City subways may get flooded.
Right.
And it was like 2 months later.
Right. Well, this is, you know, if you look at the predictions from decades ago and you look at what's happening, we predicted all this, the superstorms, the unprecedented floods and wildfires and heat waves that you see.
You say that, but didn't you kind of go back and change some of your documents?
Right. We traveled back in time to change our predictions to match what actually happened in the future.
I mean, how hopeful are you? Let's do the hockey stick
of optimism
in terms of our mood.
Yeah, there you are.
Because lately I've just been having these shows where at the end we're just like, oh no. I had a character that I called the Depressed Senator, and this was, Mr. President, I rise today to speak about climate change. We're doomed. I would suggest the absence of a quorum. And that was the character.
It's pretty good.
Mr. President, I rise today to talk about the situation in Syria. There's no hope. I would suggest the absence of a quorum.
We're laughing about the end of the world as we know it. But the fact is that we still, you know, this is my mantra these days, is that there is urgency, but there is agency, which is to say, yes, not only.
Oh, man, that sounds like a politician.
I know, well, you know.
Wow. It's, you could do better than that.
No, that's the best I can possibly
do. Okay, okay. Agency means you can do
something.
You can
do something about it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
you can do something about it.
Yeah, listen, everybody out there, try to eat all the food you buy. You know, that's part of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, the most important thing that we can do, of course, is hold our politicians accountable for representing our interests rather than the polluting interests, right?
That.
So
that's
voting and doing everything we can to expose denialism and bad faith politicians, and organizing and engaging in whatever actions we can to try to force our policymakers to do what's right. The person on the street, we can't pass a carbon tax. We can't introduce incentives for renewable energy. We need our politicians to vote for these policies.
Yep.
So to ultimately solve this problem, we
and,
need
and we
accountability.
Know, we know which party we have to vote for in order to do that, at least right now and for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, unfortunately, that wasn't always the case. There were some tremendous environmental successes that happened under past Republican administrations.
Sure.
The Trump administration is trying to undo
Clean Water
this.
Act was H.W. Bush.
Nixon gave us the EPA.
That's right.
Reagan, you know, signed the Montreal Protocol. George H.W. Bush gave us cap and trade to deal with acid rain. What's happened, of course, is that that party has been captured by the fossil fuel industry. And in my view, what we need to see, you know, right now there's a battle for the soul of the Republican Party. There is the possibility that what will emerge from that is maybe, you know, a new alignment that has good faith conservatives supporting things like climate action.
Yeah.
Yeah. You think? I was just speculating wildly.
No, that's very, very likely.
Well, suffice it to say,
no,
that
we just
right
got
to
beat them. We got to beat them, and we got you know
vote
what
out of office,
and we got to do what you're doing, and we got to get the message out to people, and the American people have to go like, okay, guys, we're not going to vote for you if you're not voting to address this, because I got grandchildren.
The good news is that you know, you've probably seen this. The number one issue right now among Democratic voters, now, Republican voters, that's a completely different thing. Democratic voters, number one issue now is climate change.
That's what I started this on. I said that if you ask people what's the greatest existential threat to the planet, boom, climate change. They will say that number one.
I think that there is sort of this cognitive dissonance, right, between on the one hand, this notion that, hey, I'm a loyal conservative. I have to deny climate change. But, hey, I'm witnessing unprecedented impacts.
Well, we have to win this battle, and we have
That's
to.
Right.
People kind of go up and down a little bit, depending on what, you know, Gore raised it, and then it kind of came down, and then hopefully, you know, the wildfires in California raised it. Had to.
That's just California, though. They're all Democrats, right?
You know, in Montana, in Colorado,
that's right.
in all over
that's
the
what,
damn place.
That's happening. Texas,
yep.
absolutely. And it's changed.
And drought in Texas and the drought in New Mexico. And
that's
and,
right.
And so people are, you know.
They're seeing it with their own two eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there is that. And if you pay a price as a politician for denying it, then pretty soon they'll stop denying it. And so the money won't mean as much as actually the American people convincing them by saying, you know, hey, come on, we see it, we see it.
And the question, you know, historically what happens, of course, with those candidates is the Koch brothers come in at the last minute, flood, saturate the media market with campaign ads for their preferred candidate. And so that price isn't paid. Too often, the climate change denier, denying politician, governor, senator, House member, what have you, is saved in the end by fossil fuel money and Koch brothers money. I don't think that that's going to continue to work.
Let's hope. Let's hope. And thank you for your work. this is hopefully going to be an issue in 2020 race, you know, if we can discuss issues. If we can discuss issues.
Right.
Because the last race was just the Trump circus and right. Hillary's emails. And right. we need, as a country, we yeah. need to be able to have conversations like this.
Well put.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me,
DJ Fu,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the new Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Once Upon a Beat.
The early 2000s was a wild time for reality TV. There seemed to be an endless supply of shows that delivered entertainment for us, but trauma for children. I'm Misha Brown, the host of Wondery's podcast, The Big Flop. Each week on The Big Flop, comedians join me to chronicle the biggest pop culture fails of all time and try to answer the age-old question, who thought this was a good idea? We recently looked behind the scenes of what was really going on at Abby Lee Miller's dance studio. Abby's biggest misstep wasn't screaming nonsensical catchphrases or throwing chairs on television, but instead, she was choreographing financial fraud in plain sight. Join me to break down all the wild details of Abby Lee Miller's story. Follow The Big Flop on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Big Flop early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.